Well, welcome along to the Racing Post Halftime Team Talk here on the Racing Post YouTube channel in association with SBK. Jump onto the website, betsbk.com. And we're in good company as well, as we're halfway through the season. Before I get the oranges out for the Halftime Team Talk, we'll introduce the panel. One of the sharpest minds in football media, Mark Langdon, joins us.
Hi, Dave.
And one of the largest hands in football media. And, of course, former England goalkeeper Paul Robinson. Paul, it's lovely to see you. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me. I thought I was the sharpest mind. Obviously been out. Don't know, wondered where you're going with that one.
You're in good company. Listen, we've got a shrewdy with us. Listen, Mark, I think we're 21 games into the Premier League season. We're going to call it half-time, if you like. What have you made of the season so far, generally?
Yeah, I don't think it's been a fantastic season. I think it's fine to say that, really. And if you have a look at the congested middle, really, of the Premier League, would suggest, you know, it is a much of a muchness. Liverpool have been a massive disappointment. They went into the season as, you know, title favourites, yep, and champions, and, you know, clearly not going to sort of defend that championship. Arsenal have been the most consistent team. One thing I have sort of enjoyed is the success of at least two of the promoted sides, because I think that was sort of damaging the Premier League if you came up and had no chance of staying up. So the fact that Leeds and particularly Sunderland are doing well, I think, is that's a good sign, but it maybe shows that a lot of the Premier League's not quite at it this year.
One of your former clubs, of course, Paul, Leeds, Mark's mentioned there. What have you made of them so far this year?
Listen, I thought they were banging trouble a few weeks ago. They were losing games, and there was talk that Daniel Farke's job was under threat. They had a difficult week where they played Manchester City, Chelsea and Liverpool, and there was talk that he'd been hung out to dry that week and then he'd be sacked at the end of the week and replaced because results weren't going to be as they wanted to be. And that week they were expecting probably not to pick up any points. They were awful in the first half against Manchester City, and whether by some careful planning, work on the training ground, or complete fluke, he changed to a back three at half time, something he's never done, Daniel Farke. And they played superbly well in the second half against Manchester City, putting Nemecha up front with Dominic Calvert-Lewin, and with two strikers and a back three, they actually looked good. And he started with that formation against Chelsea in midweek. First time Daniel Farke, since he's been in charge at Leeds, has changed his formation. First time that he's ever played with a back three. But actually, people think it's a back five. It's not. When you watch the way that the team play, the two wing-backs are the most attacking players. Goodmunson on that side and Bogle on that side. They push on so high, they cause teams problems with their offensive qualities. They went on to beat Chelsea that week, took a point off Liverpool, and then they went seven games unbeaten. Very, very unlucky in the last game against Newcastle. But they seem to have stumbled across a way of playing that actually suits this group of players. I thought they were banging trouble. Now you see where they are, that they're looking relatively safe away from the relegation zone. They're in a good place at the moment. Long may it continue. But Sunderland have been the benchmark, like Mark said, the way that they've approached this season. The recruitment was intense. They've got six players away at AFCON at the moment, which I thought might be a detriment to them. But you look at where they are now, sat 10th, exactly mid-table, 30 points. In all realism, the way that the Premier League is this year, they need three more wins maximum. Probably only two more wins out of the 17 games remaining to stay up. They've been superb this year, Sunderland.
And Mark mentioned that, we'll call it a rut, if you like, where the promoted teams are almost, it was inevitable they were going to be the three that came back down, but that clearly doesn't look the case this year.
Well, the Premier League has been a closed shop for two or three seasons now, and it's been very, very difficult for teams to break that mould. But actually, you look at Sunderland, they're going to do it this year without a shadow of a doubt. Leeds look like they're on course to do it. Burnley, unfortunately for them, they look like they're going to be one of the three to go. And I think for West Ham and Wolves, we know how poor that they've been. West Ham, you always think there's a chance of them getting out of it, 7 points adrift. But actually, when you look above them, who are they going to reel in? Nottingham Forest are above them, Leeds are above them, Bournemouth are above them, and then it's Tottenham. Tottenham are not going to go. Bournemouth are very unlikely to go. Leeds, you would think, are the most likely that could get reeled in. And I don't think Forest will go under Sean Dyche. So actually, like you say, that it's been a closed shop, but it's not a good thing for West Ham and Wolves this season.
All right, we'll steady on the West Ham.
Oh, apologies, I know.
No, right.
moments in and we're already on to the West Ham.
I like Paul's confidence that Tottenham are not going to get dragged into
relegation.
Listen, it's a World Cup year as well. We're going to tackle the World Cup a little bit. Plenty of England experience. You must be looking forward to that. It was remiss of me not to ask you, Paul, like, what are you your involvement in the sport now? Are you just media, coaching? Where are you in football now?
No, heavily involved in the media. You know, 3 or 4 games a week, covering a lot of games in this country, in different countries as well, all over the world, all over Europe. So very, very much enjoying the second part of my life and looking forward to going out to the World Cup. You touched on the World Cup.
Brilliant.
I'm going to be there covering it on the ground. So it's going to be good. It'll be my 3rd World Cup that I've covered. That shows how long it is since I retired. Tried to work it out, and then I was looking at it. I thought, oh, well, there was that strange year with COVID where the World Cup got moved. So I was trying to de-age myself a little bit. But yeah, this will be the 3rd one that I've covered.
Oh, brilliant. Right, well, we'll get on to all of the World Cup. We're going to start with the Premier League, and we're going to start with the title race, if you want to call it that already. Mark, you mentioned Arsenal. The time of recording, they've just drawn 0-0. With Liverpool, a missed opportunity to extend.
Yeah, like, I don't like to get sort of too excited. You know, we go, oh, it's a must-win game, or you
it
can't
felt like
this
a
one.
Big occasion last
it was,
night.
It was a big opportunity. I think 8 points would have been insurmountable for Manchester City. 6 feels much more doable, even though it's only 2 points. But I just don't think City are going to put a run together consistently enough to actually get those 6 points back. So, like, it was a missed opportunity for Arsenal, but they are very much the title favourites. Their squad is better than City's. Like, there's more depth to it. They've been building towards this for 5 or 6 years. This is the moment, you know.
It's got to be. Surely it's got to be the moment.
I mean, if it doesn't, you wonder where Arteta will kind of, you know, run out of excuses if they don't get it done this time around. Gyökeres hasn't been brilliant, but they've not needed him to. I think Rice has been probably player of the season, been fantastic when he's been there. We know how good they are defensively, and the goals come from, you know, a variety of sources, including corners and free kicks. So, like, with City, picked up a couple of really big injuries as well recently, so reliant on Erling Haaland. I just think, and they've got harder running. If you look, they've not been to Chelsea yet. They've not been to Anfield, not been to Old Trafford. Their record at Tottenham stinks, and they've got to go there. Like, I mean, Arsenal have got a lot of their hard away games out the way. So a stumble against Liverpool, but very much the title favourites, and I'd be surprised if they don't win it.
Mark, you think it's a point that they'll probably look back on in hindsight and say that was a decent point, actually?
Yeah, I mean, we shouldn't rubbish Liverpool too much, should we?
Yeah,
I mean,
no, it's a decent point.
It's not a disastrous point. It's not like they've played Burnley or Wolves and dropped points. So,
interesting point you made about Gyökeres, and Paul wanted to bring you in as an elite goalkeeper from set pieces. They've been absolutely deadly. I mean, how would you cope with the likes of Gabriel charging in at you, trying to get on the end of these crosses? Like, it's tough to defend against.
Yeah, it's very tough to defend against, and you see the way that they use the blocks as well. Very, very clever what they do, Arsenal, the way that they have the set plays. They put the man on the goalkeeper. I mean, that's nothing new. There's a lot to contend with, and they've got a lot of different variations, but the one thing that is consistent is the delivery. You know, any manager will tell you it's okay doing all your movements and your setup in the 18-yard box, in the 6-yard box, and working out who you're going to block and where you're going to run, but if the delivery's not right, that's where the problem lies. Arsenal's delivery is second to none. Declan Rice, incredible. Saka, when he takes them, their deliveries are what they've worked on, and the set plays is a big, big asset to them. And we're seeing it more and more now, aren't we? I mean, like, you're looking at the betting aspect now. You're backing central defenders to score. Yeah. You're backing, you know, the taller players in the team, because you know that teams will use the long throws. They'll use the set plays. There's a lot of value when you look at that type of market now.
You'd rather back Gabriel than Gyökeres, wouldn't you, I think, for a goal?
Well, yeah, I mean, this is what I'm saying. I mean, there's 6 points clear. They're 1-4. Paul, is it over?
No, definitely not. I mean, we talk now, we say, oh, you know, West Ham are done, Wolves are done. There's a long way to go in this season. I mean, it's only 2 weeks ago we were talking about Wolves being the worst ever Premier League team. All of a sudden they've hit a bit of form. They've now got 7 points. They're 4 points off the worst total. They're not going to be the worst Premier League team. There's a lot that can happen. I agree with what Mark said about Manchester City. If there's any team in that Premier League, I thought they were the ones that were capable of putting a run together. But actually, on recent form, their recent draw at home against Brighton, they've dropped points at home where you wouldn't have expected them to drop points. The Chelsea game is another one. The late Enzo Fernandez goal cost them points. They've dropped too many points, Manchester City. But if Arsenal do stumble, they'll be there or thereabouts, Manchester City. But it's Arsenal's to lose. Listen, they're in the driving seat, 6 points clear, with 17 to go. They couldn't be in a better position. But I looked at the fixtures. When you look at January now to February, you look at the fixtures, last night's games included, between now and the 3rd of February, Arsenal play 9 games. There's the FA Cup that kicks in. They've got the Carabao Cup. They've got the Champions League that kicks in. They've got 2 Champions League games. They've got Carabao Cup semi-final against Chelsea. They've got FA Cup against Portsmouth this weekend. Out of all the teams at the top, Arsenal play 9. Manchester City play 8, Villa only play 7, Liverpool play eight. But out of Liverpool's eight, there's five Premier League games. So Liverpool could actually close the gap. For me, it's Arsenal with the squad depth that they've got as well, what you touched upon. For the first time, they've now got a player for every position. Last season, they got one or two injuries, there was a problem. Now they've got one or two injuries or players out of form, they've got the squad depth. If you look at the signings they made, Eze Madueke made such a difference to that side. And Declan Rice is looking like the bargain of the century at 100 million.
Yeah, there was talk of him, Ballon d'Or and everything. Mark, we've got to talk about Villa. The same points as City, they're on 43. I think they went six without a win first.
Yeah,
start off the bat of this season.
A lot of negativity around. I mean, like Unai Emery is a fantastic coach. It didn't quite work out for him at Arsenal, and I don't like that reverse engineering in that, you know, they should have given him another 5 years. I think it's okay to say he's a great coach. It didn't quite work for him at Arsenal. It doesn't work for every manager at every club. And so he's gone to Villa. It seems to suit him really well. He's got a lot of control at Aston Villa. Everybody's buying into what he wants. There's connection with the fans, the squad. Everybody knows what they're doing. I don't think that they'll be anywhere near the top two come the end of the season. All about qualifying for the Champions League for them. And as Paul was saying, there's still a long way to go. A lot of their wins are by one goal. Doesn't take much for those kind of, that 11-game winning run that they were on. Suddenly, like against Crystal Palace the other night, 0-0 there, that's a bad result. I think if you want to really be challenging, like you need to go to a depleted Palace and win. Like I don't think they're absolute certainties to finish in the top four. I still think that teams will be looking that they can reel them in. So I think from Villa's point of view, just make sure they qualify for the Champions League, and that's a great season.
Certainly a school of thought that they're defying the XG. I think Morgan Rogers on his own.
I would be a kind of, I am kind of married to the...
an advocate of it.
I am definitely, in terms of expected goals. I know where its flaws are, and I think that that's the key thing is to not take it on like a one or two or three or four game basis.
Yep.
It's just saying that over a season and that, you know, half a season in, like you cannot keep scoring the type of goals that they have been from outside the box and at the other end of the pitch. They've been getting away with it at certain points. So like, I do think that they will kind of get reeled back in. They've got a big gap now, so they'll be hoping they can finish in the top four. I think the title is fanciful. I know they're only 6 points off, but a long way to go.
Them and Sunderland's XG is incredible, isn't it? Yeah. When you look at Sunderland as well, how they're outperforming their XG. Sunderland, one of, if not the lowest scorers in the Premier League. I did their game and looked at the stats a couple of weeks ago, and you're thinking, how are they where they are with the lack of goals that they've scored? But both them and Villa, such low XG, but the goals that they score.
OK, well, Mark mentioned Champions League. Let's talk Champions League places. Then we've touched on the title. We think there's going to be maybe five places up for grabs, but there's top four betting with SBK. Well, come on then, Paul. Who are we going to be the top four come the end of the season? We've currently got Arsenal, City, Villa, Liverpool, but lurking are Brentford, 2 points off fourth, Newcastle, 1 point behind alongside Man United, and Chelsea, lagging as well. Who do we see sort of maybe making a charge?
Well, listen, I think you can write Brentford out of that. I think they're just in a really good run of form at the moment. I, like many others, tip them as potential outsiders for relegation candidates this season. At the start of the season, I think Keith Andrews has done a wonderful job with them. Their home form in the striker Igor Thiago, the Brazilian, the leading goal scorer Brazilian in the Premier League they've got this season. He's always worth backing, especially at home, to score goals. I don't think they'll stay there, Brentford. Newcastle, I fancy, maybe could have a late charge for those places. You look at Manchester United, what are they going to do? I mean, they're still only 2 points off, 3 points off, sorry, off the top four. Are they got an outside chance of it? I think their managerial appointment is key. Have they got the quality in which to get there? I'm not sure they have. Newcastle have done it before. Chelsea, under Liam Rossini, that's an unknown quantity. We don't know how they're going to react. We know how inconsistent Chelsea have been. Listen, Arsenal, Manchester City, Villa, Liverpool, I think potentially are your top four. And then your fifth place is up for grabs with a number of clubs.
I'm not amazed that Chelsea bought in Rossini because, you know, it's the model that they use.
Yeah.
But like, if you actually just look at the bare facts of kind of the coach that they've gone for, I mean, it's a big risk, and let's be kind and say, you know, he might grow into the role. But what happened with like Maresca is that Maresca started to feel comfortable in that position. He won a couple of trophies and thought, you know, I'm the big boss here, and then found out quite quickly he wasn't. And from that, you would, and the way they got rid of Tuchel, you would assume that they want from the outside looking in, they want a puppet that they can just kind of, you know, they can manage. And he's kind of, Rossini's role is not as powerful as what other Chelsea managers would have had in the past. Like, I'd be nervous of thinking about them now for top four, because we just don't know what's going to happen there. They've got a really talented squad, but like it fell apart this time last year, didn't it? And it's happening again. Like, I would expect Liverpool to finish in the top four. You know, they've got a lot of players out at the moment, but when Salah comes back and Ekitike, like, I think they've got enough firepower. If Villa are to be reeled in, I think Newcastle could be the value to sort of overtake them. Like, Eddie Howe was under pressure from certain sections of the fan base earlier on in the season. I just don't get it. I think that they are a really well-coached team. Understandable that they took time to get going at the start, lost Isak. Like, you know, Voltimada coming right at the end of the transfer window. Visser was injured. Like, I think that Newcastle are a really good side, really well-coached team. Very difficult to beat at home. And if somebody does sneak in, I'd much rather say them than Manchester United, who seem to live in the past.
Well, they're 49-10 to break into the top four. Newcastle of SBK. You've both given them a strong word. That's a good bet.
Yeah. And when you look at the Champions League now, five of those teams that we're talking about are playing in the Champions League now.
Currently,
Arsenal
yeah.
sat top. Manchester City fourth. Liverpool ninth. Newcastle, Chelsea, 12th and 13th respectively. Obviously, Tottenham got in that competition by default by winning the Europa League. Whether they should or shouldn't be there, they're not going to be there again next year. But actually, when you look at the way that the English teams are competing in that league, Newcastle been there, done it before, doing it this year. Got two tough games. They're at home to PSV and at PSG for the remaining two games. But they're looking like they could qualify again. And I think through the league, the test for all those English clubs that we talk about is the squad depth and being able to compete on both fronts, because the Champions League, it kicks back in, and what is it, the 20th of January, first Champions League games kick in, and there's two Champions League games between now and the end of January. Talk about those fixtures, and a lot of the Premier League talk that we've had, Champions League talk, it's how those clubs handle that amount of fixtures and the squads.
Oh, I'll bring back Klopp to moan about the congested.
You see, I don't get that, Dave. I don't get that. The managers that moan about the fixtures, if you're going to be the manager of a successful team and you want to win games, you know at the start of the season what you're going to do. Yeah. If you're a successful manager and a successful team, you're going to play that amount of games. I'm sorry, if you're not playing that amount of games, you're getting a sack because you haven't done what you're supposed to do.
What about Mark touched on it there, even from, you know, it wasn't too long ago, you was playing at the top level, Paul. The dynamics in a football club now, like, we talk about Rossini coming in as more of a coach than a manager.
Yeah.
It's a different world now. Like, management within a Premier League football club with directors of football, you know, it just feels like quite a few clubs, it's just very messy.
Yeah, show me that model anywhere that's worked. The manager manages the football club. You look at Jurgen Klopp at Liverpool, you look at Mourinho in his time at Chelsea, you look at Pep Guardiola at Manchester City, you look at Unai Emery at Aston Villa, they're managers. This structure at Chelsea, listen, Liam Rossini is an unknown quantity at that level, and it's like a young player. You know, you're saying, oh, he's young, he's inexperienced, he's not ready. But how do you get experience if you're not given that opportunity? We don't know. We can all have an opinion. And my opinion is, I think it's, for him, it's too early. And it's Chelsea not behaving like a big club, looking and employing a manager like that. I've got no doubt, after spending time and listening to the way that he talks and his football brain and his philosophies on football, how he gets that across to that dressing room, that amount of players, how he manages that group of players. For him, he's spoken to the media and he said how proud he is and how privileged he is and how honoured he is to meet the players. And I'm a little bit, is he a little bit inferior of what he's doing here?
How is he
going to stand in that dressing room? And it's easy to keep 11 players happy every week because you pick them. That's the easiest thing to do. You know, you say, right, this is my team this week. Immediately, 11 of those players love you and think you're brilliant. The rest of them think it's how he handles the players in that dressing room, how he sets his team up, how he reacts to a defeat. They've got Charlton in the FA Cup this weekend. I mean, if Charlton weren't sat 19th in the Championship and on such a poor run of form, you'd maybe be thinking there's half a chance of an upset here. But actually, it's testing times for Chelsea. I'm not so sure. You look at the managers they've had. You know, you look at the Tuchels, the Pochettinos, Maresca, for example, wanted to be managers. Maresca got the job because he won the Championship. He got promoted with Leicester. He won the Championship. Liam Rossini got the sack from Hull because he didn't make the playoffs. Okay, he's done a decent job at Strasbourg, but there's nothing there that suggests for me he's ready to manage at that level.
Interesting. He did get a glowing glowing reference from Wayne Rooney. I did notice actually.
They worked together, didn't they?
Derby, yeah.
But it's just, I mean, he didn't pull up too many trees in his coaching career.
Exactly.
It's just, yeah, it's one thing. I think it's one thing being a really good coach, but as that the man management side of it is a test for all of them, and particularly at Chelsea.
Okay, right. Let's get on to it then. The relegation battle, if it is even a battle. Prices of SBK, Burnley 50s on, Wolves 1-33, West Ham 11-2 on, Leeds 29-5, Forest 42-5, and Bournemouth 37-1. I'll come to you first, Paul, because you've already sort of given a glowing reference yourself about Leeds and how you think they've maybe turned a corner. They're fourth in. So with SBK, with a lot of the bookmakers, they're kind of the club that might get sucked into it. What are your thoughts?
No, I have that right. When you look at it, I think having played for Sean Dyche and knowing what he's like and spending time with him at Burnley and having done what he did at Burnley, keeping them in the Premier League and taking a team like Burnley on the budget that he had to European football, I know how he works and I know the way that Nottingham Forest will be working on the training ground. He won't prioritise the FA Cup this weekend. We're talking on, you know, the Wrexham tonight. I won't be surprised. There's a little bit of good value in Wrexham this evening, I think. He won't prioritise that. They've got European competition to contend with, but his remit when he came into Nottingham Forest will be to keep them in the Premier League. And I think with the squad of players that he's got and the response that he'll get from those players, I've got no doubt that Forest will be safe. Leeds, if they continue doing what they're doing, I mean, they were undefeated in seven games before they went to Newcastle, and arguably they shouldn't have lost that game. They lost that game to the latest ever Premier League winning goal, which was an incredible way to lose a game and to end a run. Dominic Calvert-Lewin scoring goals. I know we're going to talk about the England squad later. Is he an outside bet for that, the way that he's playing? Leeds have got players in form and they've got a system that seems to work. Other than Nottingham Forest and Leeds, points-wise, can't see Bournemouth getting sucked into it with Areola. I think they're too good of an outfit, although Semenyo's gone today, so we'll see how they do without their main goal scorer. Tottenham, no way he'll get sucked into it. Crystal Palace, no way. Everton, no way. So the bottom three are looking pretty much nailed on. You two that could potentially, but I've just made a really good argument why they won't, is Leeds and Forest. I don't know what you think, Mark.
Of those, I would say Leeds are the most likely, but I don't like to say it's all done and dusted, but I think it's really difficult to see like where, like West Ham are the most realistic team to get out of it, but like, you're asking them to go on a run that sort of makes them almost like a European sort of side. They're going to need to pick up a sort of points per game ratio that they don't look anywhere near capable of doing and haven't done for a long time. The managers keep changing. The players are pretty average. I mean, you'll watch them every week, Dave. Like, probably
not something I'm proud of, but
no,
yes.
Well, yeah. I mean, the two.
Are you one of the ones that still goes?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Leave
yeah.
a whole time.
It's very toxic. It is very toxic. There's all sorts of protests going on. I know one of the home games coming up, there's, you know, talk about everyone standing on the concourse for the first 15 minutes. So, you know, off the pitch, all of that's going on, Paul. How will that affect the players?
Difficult. Very, very difficult. I mean, I was at Leeds United when the financial crisis hit there and there was players leaving and the club was in turmoil. But the one thing that was never a mess with Leeds United was the fan base. The fan base supports that team. The minimum effort and the minimum requirement at Leeds shirt is maximum effort. And if they see the players left, whoever the players are, they will support the team regardless. Yes, they'll vent the frustrations at the board. They'll turn their eyes to the director's box. But actually, the support on the pitch was never wavered. And I've been fortunate enough. Yes, I've played in difficult situations, but the teams that I've played for, they've never lacked the support. And I think West Ham, to an extent, the fan base is like that now. I think, you know, it's very, very difficult to vent your frustrations without it affecting the team on the pitch.
Yeah.
And I think there's been certain protests and certain, you know, fan groups that have stayed away from games, yet they understand the fans that want to stay, because when you're a fan and you're a loyal supporter of a club, you want to be there, you want to support your team, you want to see your team win, but at the same time, you want to make your point to the board. So you're kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place as to, do I go to the game, do I show my support for the team, or actually do I feel that strongly I'm staying away because I want to vent my frustrations at the board? It's a very, very difficult one for West Ham at the moment and their supporters.
Yes, it is. I've already started checking out which grounds are going to venture in the Championship next year, Mark. So let's move on to the Championship.
Are you going to the Den?
May well. Wouldn't be my first time, but yes. Right, Coventry were a long way clear. Not so far. They're still odds on.
Yeah.
The market suggests they're the side to beat.
In our pre-season show, I did give myself a pat on the back. I tipped Coventry at sort of double figures.
All the trumpets out. So, it's not finished. This is the half-time team, so it's not over yet.
But I was going to say, but... Like, had we done this show a month ago, I would have been crowing and almost celebrating the fact that Coventry would get the job done.
Would you have cashed out or would you have left it?
No, I'm not a cash out. I'm not a cash out person. I like to, if I've had the bet, I like to see it out to the finish. I'm getting slightly nervous about Coventry. It's not just the results. The performances have definitely got worse over the last sort of month to 6 weeks. Like, I still think Frank Lampard's done a great job. He's trying to inject some new signings into the team in January because I think he's probably seen that energy just dip. They got absolutely schooled by Ipswich at Portman Road. And like since then, I wonder if there's just been a bit of self-doubt in terms of, hold on, actually, are we as good as we thought we were? And then, like, you know what the Championship's like? If you're not kind of on it every single week, you can just slip up, and then Ipswich beat them again. And I actually think that Ipswich, they're way off at the moment. I wouldn't be that surprised if they reeled them in. I still think Coventry will go up, but I think Ipswich started slowly, Premier League hangover, a big interchange, like lost a few players, brought in a load of new ones. It took a time for Kieran McKenna to get that right. He's a very good coach. He'll probably be looking, thinking, there's some of them Premier League jobs I could have had. He's been linked with Man United and Chelsea not that long ago. Like, I think Ipswich might catch Coventry. Hope they don't, but I fear that they will.
Some huge clubs down there. Cliche, Paul, you know, one of the toughest leagues to get out of. Have Coventry squandered their chance, or are they, you know, the betting suggests they're still in pole position, of course.
Well, they're still in pole position. I mean, you know, just looking at the table now, you look how many points clear that they are, but their current run of form. The Championship, as we know, has got the most lucrative game in football at the end of the season in the Championship, and it is the most difficult league to get out of. I mean, I spent a fair bit of the end of my playing career in the Championship. A lot of my time, people look at you played in the Premier League, but actually I got relegated to the Championship twice and I won the Championship once. So I've got good experience of that league. And the intensity of playing weekend, midweek, the amount of games. I mean, Coventry have got 52 points at the moment. There's still 20 or 21 games to go. You know, there's more games in the Championship left than there is the Premier League. And if anyone can beat anyone, that's the league. You look at the top and bottom of the Championship. There's clubs in that league that have won the Premier League. You know, the majority of that league have been in the Premier League at some point in recent history. There's teams in form. Watford have won the last four games in a row. Wrexham, they're on a great run. They're up to ninth. They've won their last four games in a row. There was talk of them doing the double bounce at the start of the season. Birmingham City as well. There's teams in the Championship that can hurt you. There's only one given in the Championship this season. Sheffield Wednesday are going down.
Yes, it does look that way. Right, shall we get on to the World Cup then? Before we start, Paul, of course, your experience playing in World Cups. Talk to us. Obviously, it's the pinnacle.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the risk of an old cliche, it's everything you dream of as a kid. You know, you sit and watch World Cups growing up and the memories that you have. For me, 2006 was the one that stuck out under Sven-Goran Eriksson. We went there as expected to win. And the pressure and the intensity, but the expectation. Nobody puts more expectation on the England team than your own players, than yourself. And it's very, very difficult because there's a lot of hype and a lot of focus and scrutiny around the side. And rightly so in 2006, because the team that we had, the squad that we had, was incredible. You look at the players. I mean, you don't have to list the players, but you go back and you look at the starting 11s, you look at the squad, and we went there as one of, if not the favourites, and understandably. And the English media at that time were all very good at building teams up and hyping teams up and knocking them down very quickly. And back then, 20 years ago it is now, the media was very different to what it is now. And I think the scrutiny that was on that side and the weight of the jersey weighed very, very heavy. I think Gareth Southgate did a really good job with the media of tempering the expectation, bringing the media on side and getting people to understand what playing for England was all about. And the expectation levels maybe dropped, but again, I think it's risen again. I don't know what you guys think, but I think it's the same as anything. It's a phrase that I like to use. With success comes expectation. It's like anything at a football club. When you have any type of success, I mean, the expectation, for example, in the Premier League this season for Sunderland would have been to, the reality would be to stay in the Premier League. But they've had success now, so they expect to win every week at home. So the thing with England is, I think that they're getting to the level again now where, right, well, we've got this player, we've got that player, we've got Bellingham, we've got Kane, we've got Foden, we've got Saka, we've got Declan Rice, we should be going there and winning the World Cup. And the expectation for me is risen to that height. And in 2006, it was difficult to take that in. But I think we accepted it as a team and we were ready for that. Did we play well, particularly well in the tournament? I don't think we did. I think the best game that we played was the game that we got knocked out against Portugal. When Wayne Rooney got sent off, the togetherness and the unity that we showed in that game to actually get to penalties was a huge achievement in itself. And when we got to penalties, I just thought that was it. We get through this and we can go on and win it. But unfortunately, as we know, history is what it is, and we got knocked out on penalties. But to play in a World Cup for me was an incredible achievement. The pride and the passion. I was such. I'm a proud Englishman, and to represent my country on that stage every time the national anthem was belted out, regardless of who you were playing and where you were playing, was a proud moment. But that first game in the World Cup, it was something special. You look back at that team lineup, we all had arms around each other, and it was pretty much like watching England play rugby union. The way that the national anthem was belted out, and a few of the boys, you could feel it. You know, the tense, close to tears. I was certainly welling up before the game. And just the anticipation of what the whole World Cup brings. Incredible experience.
It's mad, isn't it? Because we've watched it in the pub, and you know, the bloke next to you is going, oh, he's rubbish. You think...
Who, me?
Well, no, just everyone. You know what it's like.
Is that you, Mark?
Bloody hell. No, I was very much, as a Spurs fan, Paul, you know, I was very much behind you. But you know what it's like. You're in the pub and, like, you know, he shouldn't be playing. He's no good. You know, and you think, like, to imagine how many kids play football. And then to be good enough to be a professional, then to be good enough to be in the Premier League, and then to be good enough to play for England. Like, the amount of people, like, you've had to battle against to get to that level, I always think it's astonishing. And, you know, I think it's underappreciated, kind of, the level that you have to be to get right to the top. And the fact that England have now got a squad that, like, it could be 40-odd players where... Like, you just get, like, they are, like, absolute elite performers.
It was interesting what Paul said about, you know, success breeding expectation, because we have gone deep, haven't we? So, you know, if we don't make it out of the group or whatever, it's going to be a massive failure, because almost become accustomed to going deep again.
Well, two Euro finals in a row, knocking on the door in World Cups. Like, I think you have to accept that England are... if not the best team, one of the best teams, and go there with a massive chance. Now replaced, you know, what some people felt was the problem in Gareth Southgate, in terms of, was he kind of up to the... He did it very well initially in terms of bringing the kind of country together again. Yeah. Then it's like, right, but can he take us to that final step? It was decided that Thomas Tuchel is that person, won the Champions League, you know, great experience at the very highest level. Is that person? I personally would much rather see an English manager of the England national team, even if they haven't got the CV. I think that's what international football should be, your best against our best. But, like, Tuchel, from a record, yeah, the squad that he's got, like, you can't go to the US and say, like, England are not among the favourites. They have to be. They have to embrace that.
We're going to talk betting on who's going to be in the squad, who's going to make it, but... That was an interesting point that Mark made there, Paul. I mean, yourself, being in an England camp, would it be something that would even bother you, affect the camp, that the guy leading the charge is not English?
No, well, obviously I had it with Sven Goran Eriksson. Yeah. And I agree with Mark, I think, because, as I say to you, I'm a proud Englishman, and I think it should be our best against your best. But if our best is not available, then get the best of what is available to try and get us over the finish line.
A winner. Tuchel.
And I think we've got to a point now as a nation where we'd have anyone managing, so long as we'd lift a trophy, yeah, in all honesty. So long as somebody can deliver a trophy, whoever manages that team, yeah, but I agree, it should be ours against yours. But actually with Sven, when he came in, did things very, very different. What I've noticed over the years is playing all these... The managers that come in, the foreign managers come in with a huge reputation. When Fabio Capello came in, played with many, many different managers of different nationalities, you cannot reinvent the wheel. It's a variation of the... No manager have I played for and I've walked into a dressing room and gone, wow, that's different, that's evolutionary. You know, the game is how it is. You can have different varieties of it. And I think going back to 2006, apologies, but... The squad we had, and people talking about the phrase square pegs in round holes, we played a 4-4-2 system or a 4-4-1-1, and it was very rigid. You know, Paul Scholes was playing on the left-hand side, not in that World Cup, he'd retired before then. We had Joe Cole on the left-hand side. We had players playing in a 4-4-2 system. We would play that system and put the best players into that system. Whereas you look at the way that football's evolved now, the way that modern-day managers, you play three at the back, you play three in behind the main striker, you play two holding midfielders, you play a pivot, you play a deep-line midfielder, you play a number 10. Actually, in a fluid system like that now, I think we'd have probably achieved more as a team playing in different systems that suited getting the best out of the players that you had, in all honesty.
Interesting. Well, let's talk about who may or may not be in the squad. Let's start between the sticks. Yeah. Why not? We've got a former England goalkeeper with us. Nick Pope, Aaron Ramsdale, James Trafford, Dean Henderson. What are your thoughts on the three? Who are the three going to be? Obviously, Pickford is a given, right?
Pickford's an absolute given. Yeah, that's not even in question.
Yep.
And I think the biggest compliment you can pay Jordan Pickford is when you're England's number one goalkeeper, believe me, from experience, I know about it, everyone has an opinion who should be taking your job. You know, as go back to when David Seaman was England's number one, there was no real noise. Towards the end of his career, it was maybe Chris Woods, Nigel Martin, etc., should be taken over. But there was a period of time where that wasn't in question. And we haven't had that as an England team. Even when I played, there was always questions as, should he be playing? Should so-and-so be playing? The biggest compliment you can play Jordan Pickford, that noise isn't there. That noise has gone away. He's out, you know, without doubt, England's number one. You look at his stats, 31 now. He's got 81 caps. But actually, when you look at his caps, 71 of his caps are competitive caps, as in not friendlies. Yeah. So whether they're qualifiers or in major tournaments. And out of those 71 caps, 26 of those caps are either at the Euros final or at the World Cup finals. So he's got experience of going deep into tournaments. And you look at him, he's played all 20 Premier League games this season, and he's got the most clean sheets out of all. He's got 8 clean sheets playing at Everton. Dean Henderson and Nick Pope, for me, they go with him, in all honesty, right now, because they're the only two of the remaining five that are playing. James Trafford, Aaron Ramsdale and Sam Johnson. Sam Johnson's lost his place at Wolves. Aaron Ramsdale's obviously lost his place at Newcastle because Nick Pope's playing. I do like Aaron Ramsdale. I think he's a very good goalkeeper. I think he's been unfortunate the way that he was treated at Arsenal. But you can look at the way that Mikel Arteta's brought Raya in and what he's done. He's been proven right. And with Aaron Ramsdale going to Newcastle, I think he came into the Newcastle side where they weren't playing particularly well. He's played 7 times this season, Aaron Ramsdale, and he's not kept one clean sheet. Sam Johnson's played 12 times this year and he hasn't kept a clean sheet, but we know that Wolves are struggling. James Trafford went to Manchester City, expected to play. Now, I know that Thomas Tuchel likes James Trafford, and I think he's probably the one that could break into the three. But the lack of experience for James Trafford, I mean, he's 23 years old, no caps, and he's played 3 Premier League games this season with one clean sheet. So Pickford's nailed on, Henderson's nailed on, and for me, Pope goes as well. I think that's decent. I think that's a decent bet if you're having a bet on the goalkeepers going. Nick Pope, he's got his place back in the Newcastle side, and out of all the above-mentioned goalkeepers, Popey's, what is he now? He's 33, and he's got 10 caps. 6 of them are competitive. But we always have that as England goalkeepers. There's normally one goalkeeper that has an amount of caps that is substantially more than others because we don't take risks. The England don't play that many games. There's not that many friendlies, and the manager doesn't want to rotate. So actually, when you look at that now, Jordan Pickford is our, obviously, number one, 81 caps. Next in line is Nick Pope with 10. So if anything happens to Jordan Pickford, yes, Nick Pope's your next in line, but he's got 10 caps, only 6 of them in competitive games. So there's a big gap, and we are always guilty of that. Jordan Pickford's out and out number one. Henderson goes with, for me, Nick Pope. But I think the only decision that he's going to make is between Pope and Trafford.
Anything to add?
Well, it's just Trafford went to Man City and was hoping to be the number one.
Yeah.
Starts the season, then Donnarumma turns up and quickly finds himself the number two. I suppose it's whether he is able to get a move at some point in the rest of January. So I don't think there's a natural fit. I don't sort of see anyone, sort of screaming out, going right, and City won't want to lose kind of him as the number two in case anything happens to Donnarumma. So he's probably moved to City it looked like the great move for him, but it's probably not worked out the best.
Okay, let's move infield, if you like, or outfield. Let's talk about the number 10 role, Paul, which has been up for plenty of discussion. Who plays in there for you? And who might we see sort of make a charge who's maybe not been in the fold of the squad between now and the end of the season?
I've done a provisional squad here. And if you're asking me who plays in the number 10 role, if the World Cup kicks off tomorrow, it's Morgan Rodgers, without a shadow of a doubt, the way that he's playing. There's a lot of talk about Jude Bellingham, but I think the thing that I like about Thomas Tuchel, he's not afraid to make big decisions. I think the way that he handles himself in the press, he's quite jovial, he gets the English sarcasm, he gets the English humour, but actually he's quite ruthless and he'll make decisions that suit him. I was at the England game in Serbia when he changed he was missing a lot of players. He changed the team a lot and the team actually became the star. And I think when he saw how well the team played, there was a lot of criticism of Tuchel. I think that was the real point, because he's been saying it's coming, I'm seeing this in training, I've seen that, this is going to happen, you know, we're on the right track. And then all of a sudden in Serbia, he was without one or two players, a bum, stuck five goals in. Madueke that night was outstanding. Morgan Rodgers was outstanding. And I think we saw an England team that without its so-called star players, the team kind of took over and shone. And I think that's the big thing with Thomas Tuchel. He's not afraid to make those big decisions. There's a lot made about his relationship with Jude Bellingham. And I think at the time, in recent squads just gone, Jude Bellingham obviously missed the start of the season with his shoulder injury at Real Madrid. Getting back now, getting back to playing in the same way as Trent Alexander-Arnold. He's had a really slow start to his Real Madrid career. His place in the squad is under threat. But there's a lot of quality. Phil Foden, Cole Palmer. Again, going back to 2006 and that reference, all of those quality players, you don't just play them for the sake of it. Take you back to when Lee Carsley was in charge, when they played the Republic of Ireland at Wembley. He did it. He thought, right, I've got all these attacking players. Let's put them all on the pitch at the same time. It doesn't work. You have to have a cohesive team. And that's what Thomas Tuchel is very good at, and those decisions. If the World Cup starts tomorrow, Morgan Rodgers plays. And you don't just shoehorn Bellingham in for the sake of it because he's Jude Bellingham. If he's playing to a level and it benefits the team, you put him in. And Thomas Tuchel's the type of manager that will make that choice.
I think Rodgers, I'll go for a slightly different reason. In just I think Harry Kane wants somebody like Rodgers to play with him. He'll make those Dele Alli type runs where he'll run in behind it. Yeah. And I don't see Jude Bellingham making those type of runs. Bellingham always attracted to the ball. He's a bit kind of like an under 10s player where he just wants the ball all the time. And it's quite a nice, when it goes well, that's really nice. But actually, like, I don't think that's, Harry Kane wants to drop deep. And so he needs people to run in behind. Cole Palmer is another one that doesn't really go running in behind. He wants the ball to feet and then to look for passes. And Phil Foden just hasn't really delivered for England. He's had quite a few opportunities. I do like Foden, but again, he's another one that wants the ball to feet and then to kind of pick the pass. Whereas England have got the kind of that person in Harry Kane already. And watch Kane for a decade and more. At his best when there are two wide players that want to run in behind, Son being the one. So I think that's why you're looking at sort of Anthony Gordon and Rashford on one side, Saka on the other, and somebody that will kind of make those runs so that when Kane drops deep, there's somebody up front. So I think Rodgers will start. Yeah,
that's a really good way of putting it. When you think about Harry Kane and you look at the way that he's developed in his career and he's adapted his game as he's got older, when he does play as that lone striker, he drops in. You see him quite often dropping in midway through the opposition's half, around the halfway line. And actually, if he is going to do that, you need those players that are going to go that way. Morgan Rodgers will do that, and the wide players are going to have to do that, and that'll be a feature of England's game.
Okay, I'm sure there'll be drama, headlines when the squad's announced. Any big names you're expecting to miss out?
I think it's quite difficult to take all of those number 10s. Like he might decide that he will. We got Eze as well, that doesn't play every week for Arsenal. I don't think he'll be scared to kind of drop one of those players. But it's what, 25, 26 man squad. Like most of them probably will. The interesting one will be Trent Alexander-Arnold, because I still think he's England's best right back. He'd be in my team.
Odds never mind.
Never mind the squad. Like I think that's a big decision. I personally just think he's still amazing and would go for him. In terms of like outsiders that might make a late run, I'm going to throw out one in Luke Shaw, who like has been England's regular left back for a long time. Manchester United are not going to play a back three anymore. They're going to play with a back four. I think Luke Shaw will be back at left back. And I'm looking at some of like the other players there around. Like Miles Skelly doesn't play every week for Arsenal. I think Spence's form at Tottenham is tailed off. Livramento's been injured. It might just be an opportunity there for a really experienced player that is up to the level. We know he's up to the level because he's played a number of games for England. He's about 8-1 to make the squad, Luke Shaw. I just felt like if United do sort it out and play with a back four in future, he might make a late run.
Anyone catch the eye, Mark? Paul, sorry?
What's, you got the odds there? Livramento. What's Livramento to make the squad? Because I think when you look at a squad...
8 to 11.
Yeah, well, odds on. But I think when you look at the squad, I think the reason that he is that short is because of the versatility. If he's fit and he's playing, he can play both sides. He can actually play in the midfield as well. And I think when you are, what is it? It's a 25-man squad this time. Three goalkeepers have to be picked. And I think when you're that versatile, that gives you the upper hand on a lot of others. I'm looking at the squad. I've done my provisional squad. I've highlighted four players, maybe, maybe not. Livramento, Miles Lewis-Skelly, Eze and Madueke, depending on form, whether they're playing or not. The ones on the outside of my squad that could potentially come in there, Dan Byrne, Jared Bowen, Trent Alexander-Arnold, maybe Jack Grealish, Conor Gallagher playing well. Has he got a late shout? I think there's probably only three or four places in the squad that are actually up for grabs, and I think the betting would suggest that as well. But there is value if you look at the betting market. People like Miles Lewis-Skelly, if he starts playing regularly, he will play under Tuchel.
He's odds against, yeah.
Yeah, I think there's a decent bit of value there. Nick Pope as well, value. In the forward areas, I think we kind of know. The ones that are looking like they're going to miss out, Ruben Loftus-Cheek, Morgan Gibbs-White. The one real outsiders, Danny Welbeck, Dominic Calvert-Lewin. Could Kobbie Mainoo even have a really late run
if he plays? Because if the new United manager picks him in central midfield, if you're playing regularly for Manchester United, he's about 5-1, Kobbie Mainoo.
Free Kobbie Mainoo, yeah. Like, his brother's getting on the campaign, yeah. Getting on the plane.
Didn't he start the Euros final? Something in the England side.
Imagine sort of after the Euro final saying that Kobbie Mainoo was nowhere near kind of England recognition. Everyone would be going, what? Like, this is crazy. It doesn't take much. There's always players that come with a run in those, like, because, you know, there's still half a season to go. There's enough time to make an impact. And I probably, you know, Paul's put his list there. Like, one or two will just get injured. That'll happen as well.
Okay. Well, right. That wraps up the England chat and almost the end of the show. But I'm going to put it on you, chaps, now. I've not prepared you for this. But just give us one prediction. It can be whatever you like. Who's going on the plane? Who's going to win, lose, get relegated, get promoted, whatever. Something between now and, let's say, the start of the World Cup that you think is going to happen, Mark Langdon.
I think Ipswich are going to win the championship. I'd love to say Thomas Frank's going to lose his job, but I mean, maybe not. I'll keep that one to myself. but I think Ipswich are close enough to Coventry to make my anti-post bet on Coventry feel really uncomfortable in the second half of the season. So I'll go for that.
Okay. Paul, into the crystal ball. What you got for us?
I tip Manchester City to win the Premier League at the start of the season. And I think when you look at the betting market now, Arsenal are such strong favourites with a busy month ahead in January. Not a heavy bet, but a little outside bet. I think Manchester City to win the title are a very, very good value at the moment. I think with the additions that they're going to make in January, the amount of fixtures, say looking at Arsenal's fixtures, they played Liverpool last night, Portsmouth, Chelsea, Forest, Inter Milan, Manchester United, Kairat, Leeds, and then Chelsea again. They've got a busy January, Arsenal. It's going to be a big month for them and a test on the squad depth. Still make them favourites. But if you fancy a little bit of value, you're never going to get stronger odds at the moment for Manchester City to win that title.
Let's hope so. Let's hope it goes close. Anyway, it'd be good for the Premier League. A drama at the end. Right, a final shout out then to our sponsors, SBK. Make sure you check out their Acca Boost feature, where you can get up to 100% more winnings on your Accas with SBK. Jump onto the website there, betsbk.com. A reminder that the assist, often featuring Mark, is always on the Racing Post YouTube channel, so make sure you check out that. Like, comment and subscribe. Thanks to the guys for their time and expertise. Paul, enjoy yourself out in America, and hopefully, well, listen, England expects, right? So is it coming home?
Well, looking at the group, I know we're nearly done. Likely to face Brazil in the quarterfinal if they top the group. Argentina in the semi-final if they win the group. Spain or Argentina possibly in the final. Yeah, of course it's coming home.
We like the sound of that. Right, well, thank you for watching. Gamble responsibly, and we'll see you next time.